You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Could you have been a concert pianist, an all-star baseball player, or a famous artist? It's more possible than you might imagine, says Matthew Syed, author of Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, and the Science of Success. Mr. Syed knows a thing about success or two. He is a world champion table tennis player, a two-time Olympian who was ranked number one in Great Britain from 1995 to 2003. But he argues that he shouldn't be given all the credit for his victories and that many of the people who've come to regard as geniuses only achieve greatness through a very peculiar set of lucky circumstances. Matthew Syed is a BBC commentator, a writer who was recently named Sports Journalist of the Year at the British Press Awards. His book, Bounce, is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show. Hello.
Hello there. Thanks for having me on.
Your chapter on Mozart is called Miraculous Children, with a question mark. Are you questioning whether there's such a thing as a child prodigy?
Yes, I am. And the science on this is actually rather compelling. We look at these young people who achieve remarkable things, not just in music, but in chess or in sports, and we tend to assume that they have been blessed with a rather unique genetic inheritance, that they were blessed with huge amounts of talent that the rest of us lack. And the cognitive psychologists who have drilled down into the histories of these super young achievers have found out that in actual fact what distinguishes them is incalculable quantities of practice. They started out just like you and I, but over time, this process of transformation through very specialized practice leads them into the domain of excellence. And it's only later, those of us who haven't seen the inch-by-inch improvements, who wrongly infer that in actual fact these people are talented, when what they really have are, as you said in your introduction, unique opportunities to clock up practice.
Well, Mozart's father was a musician and a violin teacher, which was obviously an advantage. But for every Mozart, shouldn't we assume there were hundreds of parents who tried and failed to create a Mozart?
Well, that is a very credible assertion. But the science seems to show otherwise, that almost all of us who are reasonably healthy have the potential to get there. And what tends to happen is those who perform slightly less well than Mozart are those who have clocked up lots of practice, but not as much. And it is fascinating to look at the narrative histories that have been put together by psychologists like Anders Ericsson at Florida State University. And what distinguishes the super high achievers with the slightly less achieving pianists and violinists and table tennis players and so on is just the number of hours devoted to practice. I suppose one proviso, however, is it's not just clocking up practice, it's making sure that practice is effective and that the instruction that you're receiving is state of the art. But when you have, as I say, different people having access to that instruction, the one who get to the top are those who have practiced the most number of hours.
Well, does the practice makes perfect theory really explain how Mozart managed to compose so many works that are now considered sublime? Didn't genius also factor into it?
Well, I suppose two different things here. It's certainly the case, I would agree, that in the early... Let's just go in two different things here. In the early stages of Mozart's development, a lot of the compositions that he wrote were essentially reproductions of other artists. The great creative masterpieces didn't emerge until many thousands of hours. But I do acknowledge the tone of your question, which is that even if one accepts the idea that in order to become world-class, you have to put together an astronomical amount of practice, what distinguishes the alpha, as it were, from the person just below is currently something that we're just not sure about. So, for example, in golf, the equivalent of Mozart would probably be Tiger Woods. Like Mozart, he's practiced probably as much, if not more, than any other golfer in history. But what probably distinguishes him from Phil Mickelson or Lee Westwood from the United Kingdom might not just be the practice, there might be something else. But whether that's genetic or something to do with his psychology is currently indeterminate.
Well, there are people who can throw a baseball at 95 miles per hour and the next one can only throw it at 85 miles per hour. And I would assume that's because of the way their arms are structured. Michael Phelps's body with its long wingspan gives him an advantage over someone who's a lot smaller. And I think you'd probably agree that a 7-foot basketball player has something of an advantage over someone who's 5'5".
Yeah, that's dead right. So there are certain things, and you're right to identify basic body size as one of them, that you just can't change with any amount of practice. And certain simple tasks do rely on a certain anatomical configuration, which if you're not born with, you're not going to get there. But for most tasks characterized by some level of complexity, and certainly music would be amongst them, and table tennis and basketball, if I can explain it in this way, it's not height that distinguishes Michael Jordan from another 7-foot-tall basketball player. Once you reach a threshold of having the right height, it's to do with the fine motor skills, the complexity of technique, the perceptual awareness. And these things nobody is born with. Roger Federer is not the greatest tennis player because he has the right height or the longer arms. It's because, as I say, he has this amazing ability to anticipate the trajectory of the ball and to command his peripheral nervous system in such a way as to impact the ball with precisely the right degree of timing. I acknowledge that Michael Phelps has a wingspan, and that definitely is significant in swimming and in sprinting. For example, you need fast twitch muscle fibers. You can get more of them with practice. But you're right to say, with certain very specific athletic tasks, genetic inheritance matters. But at the top level, in most tasks characterized by some level of perceptual and cognitive complexity, it's the practice rather than the genetic inheritance that counts.
So what kind of practice is necessary for dramatic improvement in performance?
Well, I think it varies from domain to domain, but there are certain underlying principles that are absolutely crucial. One of them is that when you practice, you extend your existing limitations. It's so easy for all of us to do the thing that we can already do. And when we do that, we're unlikely to improve. When I was playing table tennis, I would play forehand, backhand, a regular pattern that I really enjoyed, and I would get lots of balls on the table, and I demonstrated tremendous consistency. But then I had a coach who came with a bucket of balls, and he fired them at me, with different angles, but calibrated so to be pushing my movement to its outer limits and just slightly beyond. And when you are practicing in that way, the transformation is rather extraordinary. And if one can apply that extension of limitations wherever it is, whether it's music or golf or table tennis or business, the changes are dramatic. The other thing that is important is feedback. When you miss a table tennis shot or you hit a golf ball out of bounds, you know you've made a mistake. But often in life and in business and other areas, we don't get sufficient rigorous feedback in order for us to identify where we went wrong. And if we can't identify where we went wrong, it's the same with a scientific theory. If you don't know the data that contradicts the theory, you can't improve the theory.
My guest is Matthew Syed, S-Y-E-D, a columnist for the Times of London, a commentator for the BBC, and the author of a book called Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success. It is published by Harper. So you're saying that your accomplishments as a table tennis player, can I say ping pong once in a while here?
Actually, you know, it's a term that I know is used a lot in the United States, and it's interesting. Whenever I come over there, I get asked one question, which is, could you beat Forrest Gump? And I think that would be a pretty tough challenge. But in the UK, table tennis is quite a big sport, sort of 2.5 million players and quite a lot of financial inducement for success. We don't mind ping pong too much, but I know that some people, particularly on the continent, they don't like it.
But you're not willing to say that the fact that you probably have better reflexes than I do is a factor in your accomplishment?
I'm really glad you asked me that, because this is another of the myths that I try and expose in the book. We had a table tennis player called Desmond Douglas. He was a British number one of my predecessors, and he was so fast that the top Chinese players, who have a wide reputation for extreme speed, were pushed away from the table. We made the inference that he must have been born with innate reactions so much faster than the rest of us. And if you were to play me, Leonard, and I was to smash a ball at you, you'd only have 200 milliseconds in which to react. You wouldn't get bad on ball, and you would probably think, my goodness, I wish I had the fast reactions that Matthew had. But here's the thing. Desmond Douglas was tested on his reaction speed. There was a readout on a screen, and he had to jab his finger towards the illuminated button on the screen whenever it lit up. Turns out he had the slowest reactions in the England team, slower even than the coach. And what we discovered was what Douglas possessed was not innate reactions, but enhanced awareness. he's able to look at his opponent and from very subtle postural clues and the pattern of the opponent's movement is able to anticipate more efficiently than anybody else and therefore to be moving well in advance of what you would be able to do. How was he able to develop this anticipation? Because he practiced for the first 5 years of his development, because he came from a very poor background in the north of England, in a room which was very small. So spin and strategy didn't come into table tennis when he was developing only speed. So he encoded this extraordinary ability to read an opponent's movement patterns, to get bat on ball. And I'll tell you what, Leonard, if you were to do the same kind of practice, you'd be able to do the same thing. We call it the time paradox, where really expert performers seem to have all the time in the world, even when they're reacting in a blink of an eye.
And you say that your ordinary neighborhood turned out an unusually high number of table tennis players. Is that because everybody played?
You got it. I mean, it was remarkable, really, because I had bought into the idea for many, many years, and I was blessed with real talent, and that's why I'd got to the top. But when I looked around me at the other top players in the United Kingdom, the majority of them came from a small street in an anonymous neighborhood in a suburban mediocrity in the southeast of England. And, of course, there wasn't a mutation that had affected only that street without touching the surrounding neighbourhoods. It was unique and rather unusual circumstances. And essentially, it was two things. One, we had the best coach in the UK who lived on the street. And secondly, we had the only 24-hour club in the country. So we were able to play all the time with the best coach in the country, getting unique instruction. And of course, in those circumstances, it's probably not surprising that this ordinary group of people became extraordinary table tennis players.
So shouldn't your brother have become an Olympian as well?
He did. Well, he didn't become an Olympian. My brother, who trained the same as I did, was a lot better than me. He was a national under-14 champion, under-17 champion, widely regarded as the best young player ever to emerge from the United Kingdom. Unfortunately, he got injured in his late teens. But all the cohort of people in the street who clocked up the same number of hours with Peter Charters, this wonderful coach, all became world-class.
My guest is Matthew Syed, who is a columnist for the Times of London, a commentator for the BBC, named British Sports Feature Writer of the Year by Sports Journalists Association, also the British Press Award for Sports Journalists of the Year, and a three-time Commonwealth table tennis champion, a two-time Olympian, a graduate of Oxford University, where they taught him all sorts of other things, including, I'm assuming, how to write. He's written a book called Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success, and it is published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Matthew Syed, whose book, Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success, is published by Harper. A listener who teaches math at Columbia asks what you think about mathematical child prodigies like Cantor, Ward, and Nash. They obviously weren't just practicing. Something else was going on, isn't that likely? And I think again about somebody like Einstein, who, as far as I understand, didn't practice any more than other people and yet wound up one of the great mathematical geniuses of all time.
There's been a lot of work done on the calculating prodigies, the young people who are able to compute extraordinarily difficult calculations in very little amount of time. They're almost like computers. And of course, we assume that they were born with that ability. First of all, it's obviously clear that when you have a group of children and they've just started out in calculating, some are going to be better than others. But what has been found in this, as well as in all the other areas I've talked about, is over a long period of time, even perfectly ordinary people are able to compute at remarkable speeds. And for example, Alfred Binet, who's a scientist of mathematics, he took some calculating prodigies, and then he took some people who worked in the Bon Marché department store of Paris, who had spent many, many years on the tills, having to manually make calculations, and he gave them identical calculations to compute. the people who worked at Bon Marché were faster than the prodigies for both of the problems that he gave them. And the reason is that over time, the brain itself changes. The brain that we're born with isn't the brain that we continue to possess. After many, many years of practice, you build new neural configurations and you co-opt quite new areas of grey matter to deal with the task at hand. May I just acknowledge
that? I have to follow up on that.
Yep.
So did those Bon Marché cashiers come up with the theory of relativity?
Well, quite. So as with my acknowledgement that the difference between Mozart and other great pianists is something perhaps other than practice, or maybe it's to do with, I don't know, the way he practiced. Remember, when you say that two people have practiced the same amount of time, they may have practiced differently. One of them may have practiced with a greater appetite, a more voracious desire to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may be another reason. But I think I probably would acknowledge that the absolute alpha may well have something which is quantitatively different to some of the other within a cohort. But I would just point out that none of these people have achieved any kind of creative leap. You mentioned the theory of relativity. Almost all the evidence that has been put together is that creativity doesn't emerge out of nowhere. It comes from very specific, detailed practice and engagement.
I remember speaking some years back to a violinist who told me that his first memory was of a toy violin in his crib, and he got the message. But then he pointed out that other people had gotten similar messages and had succeeded. The fact of the matter is he enjoyed playing the violin, so having it offered to him at a very young age actually worked in his favor.
And I think it's interesting, isn't it, that some people are given an opportunity to practice, but they don't really want to do it. I think in order to, as it were, continue on this long and arduous path to excellence, you have to care very deeply about the destination. The kind of tennis players who are pushed by their parents too hard too soon can often become very alienated from that, from the process of improving and engaging. And it's very important that the motivation is internalized. You have to care about it from the inside. And unless you have that mindset, I think it's very unlikely you're going to get anywhere except to burnout.
I spoke last year with Andre Agassi, who was pushed by his father, and he's very conflicted on his feelings about his success in tennis. On the other hand, I think he was quite pleased that he was such a great player. But you cite several examples from the sports world of parents who were determined to make their kids into stars, like Venus and Serena Williams' father, Tiger Woods' father. What do they do to set their children on the path to that kind of greatness?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you've mentioned Woods and Agassi and the Williams sisters. There's also three amazing chess players called the Polgar sisters. Almost all of these amazing performers started young and clocked up lots of hours. What makes Agassi unusual is that whereas when Woods is interviewed, he always says that he wanted to practice. He wasn't being forced by Earl Woods. He really cared about it himself. And the same emerges when you interview, as I have, Serena and Venus Williams. Agassi's different in that although his father had the same philosophy, in fact, his father once said, a guy who hits a million balls is going to become a great tennis player, Agassi didn't enjoy it. And it would be fascinating. I've not interviewed Agassi personally, but it is curious. He's one of the very few top performers who didn't feel a great affinity and a great love of what he did.
I wonder about how this applies to artists. I'm thinking about some of the artists who really changed the course of art history, Cezanne, Picasso, Matisse, Pollock. But if you look today at the artist with the most impact, it was Marcel Duchamp, who did the least work. I mean, Picasso and should have been the winner because he just banged out those paintings. Mm. A lot of practice. Duchamp did very little, and yet I think that if you go to art galleries today, you'd say, well, he was the most influential artist of the second half of the 20th century.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. I did do some work on Picasso, and his commitment was rather extraordinary. And some of his most creative works, where the preliminary sketches have been unearthed and put together, it is quite clear that what looks like mystical creativity is actually the product of a lifetime of devotion. Now, I don't claim to know as much about Duchamp as you do, but I would be astonished. In fact, it would overturn a huge body of work if it turned out that his wonderful art was not the product of tremendous dedication. I mean, I'll give you just one other example.
I'd love to play chess.
He did.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting because, chess is another fine example. I mean, Herbert Simon, a wonderful Nobel Prize-winning economist, did a great study of master chess players. And again, you look at a chess player playing 25 games blindfolded, and you think, my goodness, this person must have a memory that is just beyond my wildest imagination. And yet, all these chess players had played for a minimum of 10 years. But when you put the pieces on a board in a way that is not the structure of a competitive match, so if you just put the pieces randomly on a board, a chess player can't remember more than 5 or 6 pieces. What a chess player has is a vocabulary of patterns drawn through experience, which enables him to remember, to chunk the position of the pieces on the board. And what looks like amazing memory, what looks like an innate gift, actually is not.
My guest is Matthew Syed. His book, Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success. It is published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the problems you need to get past if you're going to succeed is how you deal with failure.
Yeah, I think that's actually very important. And I spend a chapter on this because I think that if you interview almost all top performers, they have not interpreted failure as an indictment of their abilities. If you imagine that you buy into the prevailing paradigm that what matters is having the requisite talent, any failure is going to be interpreted as meaning that you don't have enough talent. And therefore, it is typical for people like this to shy away from challenges because they don't want to see that they are failures. Whereas if you interpret a failure as an opportunity to adapt and to improve, you're going to continue and you're going to persevere. A wonderful psychologist, professor at Stanford University, Carol Dweck, has identified two very specific mindsets, the growth mindset and the fixed mindset. And if you have a growth mindset, in other words, you believe that it's possible to grow and develop in a domain of expertise, you're far more likely to carry on and you're far more likely not to be deterred by failure.
In terms of improving a child's performance, do you think that it's more effective to congratulate her for doing well or for pushing her to improve?
Well, it's interesting this, because Dweck did a rather extraordinary experiment where she took a group of kids and gave them a mathematics problem. And then she took another group of kids of the same ability and gave them the same problem. After the first test, she praised some of the kids for their effort, and she praised some of the kids for their talent. So for the effort-based kids, it was well done. You worked really hard. For the others, it was well done. You must be really smart. And then she gave them another set of tests, which were much more difficult. And those who were praised for effort, because they wanted to be praised again, they persevered and they performed very, very well. The kids who had been praised for their intelligence, for being smart, they were really worried about losing their smart label by failing, and so they performed less well. And the difference was really dramatic. And what Dweck concludes from this, and it seems to me to be a seminal conclusion and one which should inform all educational methodology, is that you must praise young people for effort and not for talent. Otherwise, the consequences can be very negative.
Where does competitiveness come into all of this? For example, I don't like to play card games that are competitive because I just don't get any pleasure from it. I don't get any pleasure from the feeling that I want to win, I want to win. So I guess that's why I'm not a good card player.
Yeah, I think competitiveness for most of us is quite deep-seated. I rather wonder whether or not as a species it's quite a Darwinian implication that we are very concerned about hierarchy. And in my life in sport, I've seen competitiveness at its most extreme. And I guess you're right to point out, if you're not competitive, if you don't care about getting to the top, if you don't really buy into the importance of being the top person in the field, then it's unlikely you're going to persevere that hard in a particular area.
A listener, Frank from the East Village, asks, how does age play into your theory? Obviously, the older we get, the more practice we've had, but in all but a few instances, age does lead to decline. I'm not just talking about things where you need a physical ability, but often artists have a 10-year or 15-year period in which they do their most important work, and then they kind of lose it.
Yeah, I think two things about age. Firstly, if you're in your 20s and you decide you want to become a great golfer, you're just not going to have enough time in the day to devote to it because you've got to earn a living. Whereas youngsters growing up are able to throw themselves into golf, and once they turn professional, they can do it as their career. So it's very difficult to catch up in those circumstances. But the other point of your question, I think, is that the potential for, according to my theory, the potential for somebody to continue in a domain of expertise for quite a long period of time is considerable. Because if you're practicing, if you're developing the brain and transforming your abilities in real time, there's no reason why you ought to deteriorate. And in actual fact, the scientists who have looked at this in some detail have found that those who tend to diminish in their ability level tend to just lose motivation. They've been doing it for so long, they start to practice less. And I suppose the limiting factor is when you get into late age, it is certainly true that the potential, the capacity of the brain to change begins to decline.
In the corporate world, you cite Enron as a company that worshipped talent over experience. Why didn't that strategy work out for them?
Well, this is interesting, and I must acknowledge my debt to Malcolm Gladwell here, who wrote a wonderful essay on Enron. But it goes back to the experiment I talked about earlier, praising people for talent rather than for effort. Enron was a talent company. The performers, in this case the workers, were encouraged to move wherever they wanted to in the company. Those who were the best at what they did were given huge bonuses. Those at the bottom were fired. And what tended to happen is that workers were not prepared to acknowledge their mistakes because they feared that they would be labeled untalented. In a culture which encourages effort, it doesn't matter if you make a mistake or it doesn't matter too much because people can get you to improve. And so what happened? People begin to hide their mistakes. And when you have a culture of hiding and evading, particularly in a corporate context, the consequences can be, as we saw in the case of Enron, really calamitous.
On another front, you tackle something that can get rather touchy. Why so many sports are dominated by black players, like basketball in the U.S., and African runners do so well in long-distance runs. Is this simply a matter of practice?
This is another, I think, a fascinating area. In the sort of second and third parts of the book, I go sort of beyond the practice talent debate, but this one brings it right back into play because it is such an easy inference to draw. You see blacks winning the 100 meters at the Olympics, you see them winning the 5,000 at the Olympics, and you hear people saying blacks are better runners. But I wanted to drill down a little further into this phenomenon. And what you find, for example, in distance running is that almost all of the success is concentrated in Kenya. And not just in Kenya, but a very small area of the Western Rift Valley in and around a town called Eldoret. And in actual fact, the majority of Africa is underrepresented when it comes to distance running success. It's very specific to a tiny group of blacks. And of course, if we saw a group of whites in a small suburb of New York doing well at something, and it wasn't shared by people from England or Europe or the rest of America, we wouldn't say whites are better at such and such a thing. And I think the reason we're so inclined to infer from a small group of blacks doing well to the conclusion that all blacks are good is we tend to think of black as a genetic type. And this, of course, is a myth. There is as much genetic variation within the label black as the rest of the human species put together. And my argument, and when I'll just say two things, if I may, in conclusion. Firstly, the scientist who's gone out and looked at the DNA of these Kenyan runners has found no mutation. There's nothing at the genetic level to lead us to believe that they have some kind of a genetic advantage. But what he did find is that these top runners had almost to a man and woman lived sort of 10 to 20 kilometers away from school at altitude. And so they'd run to and from school and they'd built up an aerobic capacity over time, not because they were born with it, but because of practice.
Another area where race has been discussed recently, you're British, so you don't hear about this debate, but Baseball, which was once dominated largely by African American stars, some of the greatest after Jackie Robinson broke the color line, has very few black players these days because they're more likely to choose other sports, basketball, football, running, etc. And so now we suddenly are seeing an awful lot of Latin American players coming into the sport. There, just the other day, we spoke to Mark Kolanski on the show about a town in the Dominican Republic that's produced a disproportionate number of Major League Baseball players.
Yes.
Did table tennis recruiters scout for the next star in your town?
Sorry, what was the question?
Were there table tennis recruiters scouting for the next star in your town?
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I suspect, had the street that I was born in Reading, is a street called Silverdale Road, had we been of a particular colour, had we all been coloured orange, I suspect that people would have thought, goodness me, people who are orange are very, very good at table tennis. And there would have been a phenomenon whereby all orange people from around the world had been recruited by scouts into the area of table tennis, particularly if table tennis had been as lucrative as baseball and basketball and these other sports. But in actual fact, of course, it had nothing to do with that. And what tends to happen is a subconscious bias comes into place where when you watch, for example, black players playing basketball, young black players and young white players, you tend to subconsciously make the inference that the blacks have the natural talent because of the prevailing background assumption that blacks are better basketball players. And so the dynamics can become self-reinforcing. It's a phenomenon known as it's a phenomenon known in psychology as stereotype threat.
Yeah, we saw that in soccer with Brazilian players for a long time. If you were from Brazil, you had to be a little better than everyone else. We've run out of time, but I'm sorry that the volcano has prevented you from coming here because there were some really interesting events that you had lined up. When do you think you'll be in New York?
I'm hoping to come a week on Monday. And, of course, it's disappointing not to be there. But I've really, really enjoyed our chat. It's been challenging and really illuminating.
And Matthew Saez's book is called Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success. It's published by Harper. Thank you.